What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Bree, and this week we are going to be talking about, in my opinion, one of hip-hop's greatest tragedies, the death of Christopher Wallace, better known as the Notorious B.I.G. So, yes, y'all, I'm super excited about this episode, just because I am a huge, huge fan of Biggie. We're also going to be, this is going to be a three-part kind of situation going on. So we're going to be talking about Biggie in this episode. Next week, we're going to be talking about Tupac, and then the week after that, we're going to be talking about the war between East Coast, West Coast, Bad Boys, Death Row, that whole thing. So I'm not going to be hitting too much on it in this one or the next one. I'm really just going to be talking about their lives. And then part three is where we're really going to get into like the nitty gritty of what happened with the East Coast, West Coast battle, all that good stuff. And I might be able to give you guys some information that y'all don't even know. Like, I've heard a lot of information. Like, I guess technically the cases are solved, but they can't prosecute because the people are dead. But we're going to talk about that in part three. So, yeah, if you don't know too much about this case and about what happened with Biggie, I need you to go do your hip-hop history. But also, just know, trigger warning, this case does involve gun violence and a little bit of, like, drug dealing and stuff like that. So yeah, like I say every week, if any of these topics are too much for you, please make sure to take care of yourself and your mental health, and I'm sure you'll be able to join us in another episode, or as always, you can always go listen to a past episode. And like always, all the information that I'll be using is in the show notes below. I mainly use the new Netflix documentary Biggie, I Got a Story to Tell. If you haven't seen it, you definitely should. If you are a big fan of Biggie like I am, you definitely should go check it out. It's super dope. They got some really dope clips of like him singing. Like, who knew Biggie was a singer? Because I damn sure didn't. So yeah, definitely go check it out. His mom, Miss Wallace, is in it. You got D-Rock, Lil C's, like Faith Evans, everybody is in this one. I think this one is really well told compared to like some of the other ones that doesn't have everybody in it. This one has like everybody who was close to Big, people he grew up with. This one is a really good documentary. So yeah, I definitely think you should go check it out. And this one to me is different than all the other ones that I've seen. When they talk about Biggie, I feel like most documentaries spend like 50% of the time talking about his beef and rivalry with Pac and Death Row, versus this documentary that came out last year on Netflix. They really don't talk about it till like the last 15 minutes. Like, they don't focus on that. They really focus on his life, and that's really what I enjoyed about this one, is you really got to learn more about Christopher Wallace, not just Biggie Smalls. You got to learn about Christopher Wallace and who he was before he became Biggie Smalls. So yeah, with all that said, we're gonna go ahead and hop into this week's episode. So, Christopher George Latour Wallace was born May 21st, 1972 in Brooklyn, New York. He was raised by his mother, Valletta Wallace, or Miss Wallace, who was a Jamaican immigrant. She came to America because she wanted a better life for herself, and then ultimately she wanted a better life for her child when she found out she was pregnant with Big. His father really wasn't in the picture. His mom said he called one day and was trying to, you know, have a late night rendezvous. She was like, I ain't having that. Either you can come over in the daytime or don't come at all. And he just never showed up again. So that was the last time he talked to him. Biggie talked about it in the documentary too. Like, they have a lot of clips from like old interviews that he did, and he said that like he don't even remember him, so he really don't care. So, you know, that was his relationship with his dad. He really did not have one. I think the last time in the documentary, but the last time he saw his father, they said he was like two. So yeah, he never really saw or spoke to him. So majority of Biggie's childhood, as a lot of us know, his mother was very protective. He couldn't come off that stoop, you know what I'm saying? He lived in like a technically like a nicer side of Brooklyn, kind of, but like he lived like right on the border, right? Like, he lived like down the block was Fulton Street, and if you're from New York in the 80s, my mom lived in New York in the 80s, so she kind of could tell me about it. She didn't really run Brooklyn like that. Like, that's not where she's from. But even my mom would tell me, I've heard other stories from other people that I know that are like older than me that grew up in New York in the 80s and stuff, and they were talking about Fulton Street and how it's just, you know, it was a rough time. You know, the 80s was a rough time in New York in general. And Brooklyn was no different. Fulton Street back then was kind of like kind of like crack alley, not necessarily, but kind of, you know what I'm saying, like niggas was selling, smoking, all that shit. And so his mom was really trying to like protect him from that. He went to Catholic schools. He did really, really good in school. He was getting awards for being like this really great English student. He was an amazing writer from like a very, very young age. And you know, for a long time his mom was, you know, looking out the window like, where you going, where you at, like, nah, you need to be on the stoop. But after a while, his mom was working two jobs, his mom wasn't always home, and he did eventually fall into that life. He saw his friends that were, you know, some of his friends started selling, you know, weed and other like little shit, and you know, now they got money, they got chains, they got new shoes, they got new clothes or whatever. Now granted, Big was going to a private school, so most of the times, you know what I'm saying, he was wearing like uniforms and shit, and his friends was like, bro, you living a life better than us, because we got to worry about how we look when we go to school, bro. Like, you go to school, everybody look the fucking same. Now for somebody who went to private school like me, I feel like that's a double-edged sword, because I definitely was one of those kids that was like, I hate wearing uniforms because everybody looks the same. And then I went to public school where I could wear whatever the fuck I wanted. And by the time I was in high school, I was like, I'd much rather go back to private school where all these bitches look the fucking same, because I'm tired of people talking about clothes and how people look, because the shit was just so corny to me after a while. So I get it. I get what his friend was saying, but I also get where Big was like, nah, you know, I'm trying to go like to public school. I'm trying to be like y'all. I'm trying to be, you know, whatever. I get that, because I live both like in that sense of like private school versus public school. Being able to be like out in the street with your friends versus like being really sheltered. I get that concept, because my parents were kind of like that too, so that kind of that made sense to me. But you know, Big ended up in, you know, in that drug life. He started selling crack, he was selling weed, he was doing all that shit. But around the same time, he was about 12 years old when he started doing that, so around the same time he was also writing rhymes, and he had his little group, and they was going around, you know, busting rhymes and rapping and shit. So he was starting to make a name for himself in both, you know, both ways and both sides of this story. So his first stage name was MCC West. Now obviously we all know that shit did not stick, but that was how he started to get some traction when it came to like this whole hip-hop thing, this whole music thing. But while doing that, he was, you know, still in school, getting his education. When he went to high school, he convinced his mom to let him transfer from one school that was in, like, a nicer neighborhood to a school in the downtown Brooklyn. It was the same school that I believe Jay-Z and Busta Rhymes went to. So, like, he was, you know, out there. And by the time he was 17, he ended up dropping out. And it wasn't for him not being smart or not being able to do the work. It was because he had a smart-ass mouth. That was from his mama. His mama said, his smart ass attitude is what got him to leave school. And other people said it's his mouth. So between his mouth and his attitude, if you watch Notorious, he got a smart ass mouth with one of the teachers. And there's a lot of other stories out there of him just being a smart ass and quick with the comebacks. He was witty, you know what I'm saying? He ended up being kind of like a class clown kind of thing. But he was also really, really smart, and he would fuck up his teachers with how smart he was by also clowning them at the same time and then getting himself in trouble. So ultimately, by the time he was 17 in 1989, he ended up dropping out of high school. And with more free time, you have more free time to get into trouble. And that is exactly what he did. At that time, he got more into the drug game. That same year, that would be the first time he would get arrested for having weapons. He had guns on him, he got arrested, so he got 5 years probation. And then in 1990 he got arrested again for breaking parole. And then with all of that, like court cases and all that shit, he was like, fuck it, I'm moving to North Carolina. He was dating his longtime girlfriend Jan at this time, and like, you know, there's just a lot of bullshit going on. If I'm not mistaken, Jan had family in North Carolina, so he said, fuck it, I'm going there. But then he ended up getting locked up in North Carolina. He did 9 months in jail before he was eventually able to like get bailed out, and then he came back to Brooklyn, because again, he was just in so much shit, there was just so much going on. He was starting to become, you know, like the rest of the drug dealers on the street, in and out of jail, in and out of jail. But once he got back home, a lot of people were like, yo, this dude is different, this dude is not like the rest of us, you know what I'm saying, we gotta do something. So in 1991 he made his first demo with a local DJ that he knew, and at that time in 1991, that's when he started going by the name Biggie Smalls. Now he had always gone by Big because of his size. By the time he was 10, he was tall, but you know, he was a little heavy set, he was a little thickums, you know what I'm saying? So in 1991, he was like 6'3", 300 some pounds, you know what I'm saying? Like, he was a big dude, so he went by Biggie Smalls. He also got that name from a character in a movie called Let's Do It Again. And then also because of how big he was. So that was just something that, you know, just kind of stuck with him. Big, Biggie, Biggie Smalls, all that, whatever. So the DJ, Mr. C, who worked with Big Daddy Kane and Juice Crew, he heard the demo and he was like, yo, this kid is good. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's really on to something. And he got it to the source in 1992. So about a year later, he got it to the source. And if you know anything about the source, you know the source was like that magazine. Like, it was like Essence of hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was that magazine. Like, anybody with hip hop was in the source. So they had put Big's demo in the unsigned hype column, which is basically how Sean, Puffy, P Daddy, Diddy Combs, whatever the fuck you want to call him, that's how he finds out about it. That's how he hears it. And he's like, yo, I gotta meet this kid. Like, he sounds completely different than anything that we have been hearing. Now, LA was already on, starting to head on to their own like gangster rap or whatever, but hip-hop really didn't have the hip-hop in New York really wasn't there yet. They were still kind of in like the LL Cool J, Pretty Boy kind of thing. And Big is the complete opposite of that. You know what I'm saying? Light-skinned Pretty Boy is not Big. Completely different. Gangster rap, you know, cool, romantic, whatever, different. So Puffy was like, yo, I want to sign him. And at the time, Puffy was working A&R for Uptown Records. And they have a meeting, Big and Puffy, they have a meeting. Puffy asked Big to spit some bars real quick, you know, freestyle type shit, because he was like, in a way, he still didn't really believe it. And then he saw it, like the rawness, the realness, the, he got to hear it firsthand, and he was like, oh no, this nigga is different, this nigga is completely different. So he knew immediately he needed to sign Big, and he did. They started doing stuff. Big was on a track with Heavy D and the Boys for a movie. You know what I'm saying? They were starting to get his name out there. But probably like 6 months to a year after they signed Biggie, Uptown Records dropped Puffy, specifically Andre Harrell, rest in peace, Biggie, big homie. But Andre Harrell ended up dropping Puffy because his ego, Puffy's ego was always Big, and you know, his ego is what got him where he is. But it also got him fired from Uptown Records, which was probably the best thing that ever happened for him, getting fired from Uptown Records, because that just pushed him to do his own thing, make his own record company, and, you know, whatever. So, following getting dropped from Uptown Records, Big would have his first daughter, August 8th, 1993, which is 3 years and a day before I was born. His daughter Tiana Wallace was born, which was like his pride and joy. He was so happy. He promised her everything. Now him and his longtime girlfriend Jan, they were not together at this point, but he, you know, he promised his daughter everything. He wanted to give her everything in the world, everything that he couldn't have. Like, he wanted to give that to her. He was like, you know, if she had the childhood that I want her to have, bro, I would have graduated top of my class. Like, if I could have had the childhood that I'm about to give her, I would have graduated top of my class. I would have done so much better in life. I would have been a different person. So now he's like, he wants to do whatever he can to give his daughter the best possible life that he could. But for Big, that also meant he still needed to do his thing. He still needed to go out there, so, you know, sell, make his money or whatever. And he, that's what he was doing. Like, he was still selling drugs, he was still doing his thing. And in late 1993, Puffy found out that Biggie was still selling, and Puffy went to him like, bro, you cannot do both. It's not gonna work. You're gonna keep doing this, you're gonna be trying to make music and then getting arrested and getting locked up. Like, that's gonna constantly put your career in a hiatus. Like, we're never gonna get to where we can be if you don't put all of your attention into this hip-hop shit, bro. Like, I need your full focus, I need your attention here. And I don't know how, but Puffy convinced Biggie to put that shit down, and that's exactly what the fuck that nigga did. He put all that shit down, he put 110 in his music, and he never looked back. And like clockwork, it was like everything started flowing. Party and Bullshit hit, that shit popped. everybody knew Biggie's name. Now, granted, Biggie had already started signing contracts and shit, and he was feeling some kind of way, because Party and Bullshit was popping on the radio, but this nigga was still sitting on the corner, you know what I'm saying? He was like, what the fuck is going on? But shit started to roll from there. Shit started to move. Big could start to see the responses from the crowd. He could start seeing the responses from people around him, and he was like, okay, nah, something's happening. Now, obviously, he wasn't expecting to be what he is, but shit has started to, you know, move. And he was like, okay, he was peeping the crowds. He was looking at how, you know, the crowds would respond when he would perform. He was looking at the radio plays, you know what I'm saying? And he was starting to, this is where I feel like he was becoming a businessman for music. So at that time, when he hit the scene with Party and Bullshit, he was using the name Biggie Smalls as like his official moniker, his name. But there was some little white kid who also was using the name Biggie Smalls, and they threatened to sue Biggie over the name. And since Biggie was like, I don't got time for that shit, he was like, fuck it, I'm the Notorious B.I.G. That's what you call me. Fuck Biggie Smalls, that nigga is dead. I'm the Notorious B.I.G. Now, we all fucking know, nobody knows who the fuck this white kid is that was going by Biggie Smalls. If you type in Biggie Smalls in Google, who the fuck pops up? Christopher Wallace. Thank you. What the fuck, kid? You was never... Okay. Anyway, so for the rest of his professional career, he went by the Notorious B.I.G. So that was what was on all his like albums and stuff. But everybody still called him Biggie Smalls. Everybody was still, you know, that's Biggie, whatever. Around this time, when Big was starting to make a name for himself, he would meet one of his closest friends and one of his even greater enemies, Tupac Shakur. It has been said in many documentaries by many people and many docuseries and everything that I can think of, they were friends. They were extremely close. They used to hang out. Like, if Pac was in New York, he was at Biggie's crib. If Biggie was in LA, he was at Pac's crib. If they was in the DC area, they was hanging out. Like, they were really, really good friends. Like, they spent a lot of time together. They had made music together. Pac had brought Biggie on stage to perform, you know what I'm saying? Like, they were very, very close. And we're gonna get more into that in part three, but I just want to put that out there. Like, they were very, very good friends. The rivalry doesn't happen until 1994, when Pac gets shot at Quad Studios. This would be where their rivalry would change the trajectory of hip-hop forever. So yeah, in 1994 at Quad Studios, Pac got shot 5 times in the lobby, and then he was rushed to the hospital. From that moment on, Pac basically said, fuck Biggie, it's his fault. And yeah, that would change how hip-hop would forever move, because it changed the way that hip-hop was functioning and moving in as a whole after that. Like, everything would change. So yeah, we're gonna take a quick break, and I will be right back, and we will get back into this. We're gonna get into his love life a little bit. So yeah. All right, y'all, so we're back. So where we left off was the Quad shooting in 1994. So we're gonna actually rewind just a little bit, take it back a little bit. In August of 1994, Biggie Smalls would meet and fall in love and marry R&B singer Faith Evans. You know, I love her. And then following his wedding, he got his first pop chart Billboard success with Juicy, which was his lead single for his debut album, which was Ready to Die, which was released September 13th, 1994. And then following his album, bro hit the billboards hard. He was on the Billboard Top 200. He was getting all the love from fans, journalists, DJs were playing his music everywhere. Like, you name it, they were playing his music. It was everywhere. Out of nowhere, Biggie was everywhere. The next thing he dropped was Big Papa, which skyrocketed to number one in hip hop. And then he dropped One More Chance, which sold 1.1 million copies. You know what I'm saying? Biggie was doing his thing. He was making his bread. He was touring. His music was everywhere. Things were going really, really good. And then, as we all know, Who Shot Ya came out. And the East Coast-West Coast war was officially started. So if you go listen to Who Shot Ya, you can, I guess you could see how you would think maybe he's talking about Pac. Here's the problem that I have with that. Biggie has said multiple times that that song was recorded before Pac got shot. So it's obviously not about Pac. It's about a drug dealer rivalry. But either way, a lot of people were like, oh yeah, that's how you know Big has something to do with it, da 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 da. Especially on the West Coast, a lot of people had a lot of feelings. They heard that song and was like, oh yeah, see, Biggie did it. On top of the fact that Pac was also saying that he thought Big and Puffy and them had something to do with it. So, yeah. So, while all this is going on, Big is still growing a name for himself. But he's also really stepping into that businessman bag, as everyone likes to say. He was a very smart man, you know what I'm saying? He created the group Junior Mafia. Now, I didn't know this until I looked it up. I did not know Junior Mafia meant Junior Masters at Finding Intelligent Attitudes. Okay. All right. So a lot of the people that were in Junior Mafia were people from his childhood, friends from his childhood, different little cliques and stuff from around the way from when he was growing up. That's where a lot of these people in Junior Mafia came from. But one of these people, one of the standouts would be the Queen Bee, Lil' Kim, you know what I'm saying, whom he found and helped her build her career. He also had an affair with her, but we're not getting into that because that's just a messy whole lot of. And the information is so confusing. So if you want to go do your own research on that, let me know what you find out, friend, because baby, I was confused, okay? So I'm not going to touch on that for real. But, yeah, he has started Junior Mafia. He had all of that going. And even at one point, like, there was a conversation between Biggie and Pac before everything went to shit, where, you know, there was like a conversation about management and like Pac managing Biggie or whatever, because Pac had Thug Life and then Biggie ended up with Junior Mafia and it was just a whole thing. So yeah, that was how Junior Mafia kind of came about. So Big was kind of like the manager, the godfather, you know, he kind of helped them out. And then in August of 1995, he helped them to release their first album. Now, their album dropped following the 1995 Source Awards. Now, if some of y'all know about the 1995 Source Awards, y'all know that night was a bunch of bullshit, okay? That, to hip-hop historians, they will say that is the night hip-hop died, because there is just so much tension in the room between East Coast, West Coast, North, South, Midwest. There was just a lot of tension in that room. And I went back and watched the 1995 Source Awards, and I will link it in the show notes if you actually want to go watch it and be able to see the entire thing, because I feel like a lot of people really only talk about what happened with Death Row and what Suge Knight said, Snoop Dogg, Biggie, Puffy. Like, I feel like that's really what the only thing people talk about when it comes to the Source Awards. But like, that night was crazy for everyone. Like, Outkast got booed off the stage. Apparently Benzino was there passing out awards and all kinds of stuff. Like, I mean, I obviously saw Benzino, but like Benzino's there, and at the time nobody even knew who he was. Like, there was a lot of tension in the room. Everybody was like, you know, what's going on? Andre 3000, it was like, yo, the South got something to say. And sure enough, they did. You know what I'm saying? Like, this, that particular Source Awards was just tense. It was tense from the jump. It was like everybody had who they were standing with, and that was it. So all of that happens, and with all of the drama that was going on at the awards show, it really just pushed the issue of like this East Coast versus West Coast beef. And right after that, Pac gets out of jail, he signs with Death Row, and in my opinion, Pac signed his death certificate. Like, he signed with Death Row and he signed his death certificate. Like, my nigga, come on. Like, nobody who worked with Suge Knight for real was like, they were making money, you know what I'm saying? You had people like Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and whatever, like, they were making money, but like, it was tense. Like, it was a scary situation. There was gangs all around. Like, bruh, you know, we were living in a different time. That's all I got to say on that. But yeah, so Pac got out of jail, he signs with Death Row. If I'm not mistaken, Suge Knight helped get him out of jail, and then he signed with Death Row. And I will always say, no good ever comes to working with Suge Knight. I think everybody now knows that. So yeah. But after that, essentially things kind of calmed down a little bit majority of 96, Big was working on his next album, Life After Death, and then he had a little bit of a run-in with the police, you know what I'm saying, a little bit of running with the law in March of 96, but after that, he got back on track, he was doing his thing, he was, you know, working, making his music, but in June of 96, Pac would release his own diss track towards Biggie, and also bringing in his estranged wife. Now, at this time in 96, Big and Faith, they was going through some things, okay, they was going through some things. And it just ended up being a bigger mess. So if you've seen like the Notorious movie where they kind of discuss it, and it's just like this whole hoopla of bullshit, and Big like spazzes out. Faith has also talked about what actually happened, and like he did kind of spaz out on her. Like he just, like he was angry. Like, bro, you fuck Pac? And she was like, nigga, what the fuck are you talking about? She's like, I saw him at a party, nigga. Like, no, what? No, go away. So their relationship was already kind of rocky. Big was having another affair with a rapper, Charlie Baltimore, you know, and Lil' Kim. Like, there was just so much going on that when Pac did this, it just caused more problems, like, in his personal life. But September 7th, 1996, Pac was fatally shot multiple times in a drive-by shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada. Following him going to watch a boxing match, he died 6 days later. It's been said that many, many times that Biggie broke down. Like, he called Faith Evans crying, boo-hooing. Like, he was really upset about the fact that Pac had died, the fact that he never got the chance to talk to Pac. He never got the chance to clear the air, get past all the bullshit. Of course, there were multiple people that, you know, tried to tie Biggie to Pac's shooting, but everyone was like, yo, he was working, like, he was recording, what are you talking about? It just doesn't make any sense. But 2 days after Pac was shot, Biggie was arrested, but he was arrested because he was smoking weed in his car with Lil C's and Charlie Baltimore, people that were in Junior Mafia, and he got his car repoed, so he had to go get a, rental because he couldn't get his car back. Now, in the Netflix documentary, they talk, Lil C's talks about it specifically, and Lil C's said, like, don't take the car, like, something was wrong with it, like, I guess they had, like, test drove it or something, and, like, it just, something was off with the car, and C's said not to take it. Big was like, bro, it's fine. He ended up taking the car. They were driving back from Jersey, and they got in a car accident. A car accident shattered Biggie's leg. It shattered Lil C's jaw, and Charlie Baltimore also got hurt, but I don't remember what happened. Hold on one second. Let me find. Okay, yeah, she just got hurt. I didn't think anything crazy happened. I was like, hold on. But yeah, so she got hurt. So everybody was like hurt, but Big ended up being hospitalized for a few months. He was shortly confined to a wheelchair, and then eventually he was forced to use a cane. Which, if you look in some of his later music videos, he actually does have a cane in the video with him. But while recovering from this accident on October 29th, 1996, Faith Evans gave birth to their only child together, Christopher Wallace Jr., better known as CJ. And after this, it really seemed like Big was really kind of just focused on his family, his next album, which was Life After Death. And in 1997, once he kind of recovered and regrouped, he really started to travel and promote. He started going out to California again, really trying to promote his album, you know what I'm saying? And he had a lot of family and friends that were like, yo, you should not be going out there. Like, it's not safe. It's dangerous. But Biggie was like, nah, like, I'm good. Like, everything's good. But March 8th, 1997... Big had gone to California to go to the Soul Train Awards. He went to the awards. He went back to his hotel. He didn't go back to his hotel. He went to the award show, and then they went to an after party. They went to an after party that night, and around midnight, 12:30-ish in the morning, so now March 9th, the party got shut down because there's too many people. It was loud. It was chaotic. So the cops came in and was like, hey, everybody got to leave. So March 9th, Biggie was headed back to his hotel. He gets in his car. He's in the front passenger seat. His homie D-Rock and Lil C's are in the back seat. His homie G-Money is driving. Puffy was in the car behind them following. And the head of security was riding in another car behind Puffy following both cars to the hotel. Now, around 12:45 as they're leaving. They come to a red light. It's crowded. There are people in the streets walking around, all kinds of stuff. And a black Chevy Impala pulls up next to them, rolls down the window, pulls out a 9mm blue pistol and starts firing into the car, where Biggie was hit 4 times. They rushed him to Cedar Sinai Medical Hospital, where they did emergency surgery to try to save his life, but he was pronounced dead at 1:15 a.m. He was 24 years old. So his autopsy showed that only one of the 4 shots were fatal. It was the last one, the last shot, the last bullet that was shot at him, however you say that. It was the last one. The last bullet was the one that was a fatal shot. It went through his right hip, hit his liver, colon, heart, and then left lung before it finally landed at his left shoulder. So basically it just kind of like ripped through him. So yeah, that's absolutely heart-wrenching. Guns are trash. So yeah, the last album to be released by the Notorious B.I.G. was released, I don't know how to say this word, and I posthumously, there we go, on the it was released posthumously, and it was released on the day that it was supposed to be released. They didn't push the date back or anything. They released it when it was supposed to be, which was only 16 days after his death. It immediately hit number one on Billboard's. Personally, this is my favorite hip-hop album, like one of my favorite hip-hop albums of all times. So yeah, but following his death, there have been many dedications. If you walk through Brooklyn, there are murals of him everywhere. There are many, many songs that have been dedicated to him. Songs from Faith, I think Lil C's and Puffy or somebody did something. Like, there's so many songs out there. People have been doing documentaries and films and all kinds of things for him for a very long time. He will forever be a hip-hop legend, in my opinion. So yeah, this is the part one of this little saga that I'm doing. So next week, we're going to be talking about Tupac Shakur, his life, and, you know, ultimately his passing and just, you know, his story. And then after that, we'll go into the whole Bad Boys versus Death Row, East Coast versus West Coast, all that drama. So yeah, I definitely have enjoyed researching and recording this episode because it just gives me an excuse to listen to Biggie Smalls a lot. And next week is just going to give me an excuse to listen to Pac all week. So hey, I'm hype. I'm enjoying myself. So I hope you can join me next week. And like always, please keep sharing the pod. You can find me on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. That's TrueCrimeBLVD. I'm not spelling out Boulevard, so it's not going to happen. Or you can follow me, little old me, at _ Bria Daniels. That's BRIADANIELS. Or you can email me at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com. It's spelled the same way as the Instagram. If you have any questions, episode suggestions, comments, you just want to say hey, I do respond, I promise. Thank you again, and I'm your host Brie, and I will see you next week on the Boulevard. Bye y'all.